This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. We hope you found a safe haven from the weather and maybe some comfort from that old saying, "This too shall pass." We'll start our show today with a teacher who wants students to take a broader view of what they study. William Fritz says math majors should consider taking art, and art students, math. And since he's the National Agri-Science Teacher Ambassador in Rolla, North Dakota, he thinks all students should know something about ag, even if they don't have a farm in their future. Fritz was the guest of Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast, and he talked about how his background guides how he teaches.
I come from a very small, I guess most people probably call it a hobby farm, but we thought it was our own little farm that my brother, my sister, and I had since probably when we actually moved to Plainview. Our parents wanted us to understand and how to appreciate livestock. We actually got some cattle free first, and then after that, we would purchase our own. We'd make our own decisions, and we were responsible. Like, I did chores in the morning because I did school functions after school, and then my brother and sister did chores at night. And then we just split up the weekends of when we had to do chores. So I did that probably, you know, I remember getting up at fifth grade in the morning and doing farm chores before school and after school. And so I had a good understanding of the livestock industry and the agriculture industry because my parents really wanted us to appreciate, because they grew up in that lifestyle.
And you mentioned that as early as ninth grade, you knew you wanted to be an ag instructor.
You know, funny fact is before that, my parents actually made me take ag. I wasn't going to take it because I was in 4-H. I understood it, but my parents said, no, you're going to be in agriculture class. And so then once you get in, you realize what agriculture classes are like. It's not sitting in a chair, listening to a teacher give notes. Granted, there are days like that, but you're up and about and working with your hands. You're out in the shop. You're doing labs in the classroom. So it's kind of something that I've always wanted to be a teacher, but that kind of narrowed it right down to wanting to be an agriculture teacher.
And one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is your teaching philosophy, I guess, mm-hmm. which is inquiry-based mm-hmm. learning.
Yes.
Let's jump into that right away. An interesting approach to FFA and agriculture.
I've always done inquiry-based learning, but didn't really know it was called inquiry-based learning. Inquiry-based learning is students are kind of in charge of what they want to learn and how long it takes them to do something. Last year, I attended Agri-Science Teacher Academy down in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they teach you how to really work it into your lessons. You don't have to change your topics. You just change the way you teach it. More student-driven versus me standing in the front, having a PowerPoint. The books are laid out. Kids are taking notes. The kids actually get to learn it themselves with me guiding them through that process.
And what have you seen as you've become more aware, I guess, of this kind of inquiry-based learning and this student-driven learning? As you've been aware, I guess, of that change, have you seen that they're more interested?
Yeah, they're more active in the class because they kind of actually get to solve the way they should find the answer. So there's more than just one way to get to the end results. You know, if we're working out in the shop, I'm going to teach them one way or show them other ways of doing a process. And I go, now it's your decision of how you want to come or find your own way to get to building the project or building the model in the classroom. You get to make that decision and write it down so that other people maybe have resources to do the same thing.
You want students to experience agriculture.
Yes, I think it is important that the kids actually do the project or learn the process by actually doing it. You know, for example, at the Capitol, the bovine breeder, you know, it simulates the reproductive tract of a cow. And the kids actually go through they reach their hand in, they use the AI gun and they try to work its way through the cervix to deposit the semen into the uterine horn or wherever it needs to go. So they actually get to see it instead of just watching a video. They actually, and granted, you know, it'd be nice to actually have live animals, but again, that's not always possible living in Rolla, North Dakota, because there's very few livestock farmers up there.
Yeah.
So just having them experience it, getting them out into the fields, getting them into a business, letting them talk to a business owner or bringing the business owner in or talking to a banker about getting a loan, actually going there. And, you know, we have a lesson where the banker teaches the kids how to apply for a loan. He teaches it, and I'm just back making sure the kids are behaving and asking the right questions. So I kind of not really the teacher there. The banker's the teacher.
Yeah, as you said, it's really student-driven.
Yes.
I also wanted to ask you about a statement you made, too, about that there's a lot of students that still believe that agriculture education is just for, you know, quote-unquote farm kids.
Yes.
What do you have to say about that?
Honestly, I don't know the percentage right now, but, you know, if they could see my fingers, this is how much what farming is in the agriculture industry. It is just, I think it's like less than 10%. And they need to realize that wildlife and fisheries falls under agriculture, ag business, the whole ag processing and ag sales. And they need to realize that that incorporates almost every type of industry. And even if I tell kids, okay, you don't want to go into the agriculture industry, someone that's an accountant for like Monsanto will be doing the same thing in a non-ag. So you're going to learn the same skills. You're just going to, it might just not be an ag industry.
Highly transferable
skills. Yes. Yes. So, you know, making sure that they see that the skills that we are learning in a CTE class can be used basically anywhere in the industry. So,
you mentioned that you teach 12 different semester mm-hmm. classes throughout the school year.
Yes.
A lot of variety. Touch on some of what you teach.
Okay. So I'm a big advocate that the kids need to learn a lot of the industries that make up agriculture. So I used to have year-long classes, and then I switched to semesters to give them more of a variety. So, like, you know, my schedule right now is first hour is natural resources. Second hour is, it's small animal care just because of the way it's classified at the ESPB. But we focus on vet science. So small animal care. So then I jump into like a foundations class. It's an introductory class for younger people. And then I go into some ag sales. So kids are learning a little bit about how to sell a product. And then all eighth graders have to take ag. So that comes next. And then I end the day with an agronomy unit. And so they're learning about the different sections of agronomy.
You have talked about the hands-on mm-hmm. aspect of what's happening in your classrooms. Mm-hmm. You mentioned audio, visual, mm-hmm. Things like that. Mm-hmm. What all is incorporated is your kind of the guide on the side.
Okay. The easiest way to explain this one is when I teach welding to students, I actually bring a welder I take it from the shop and bring it into the classroom. So like the very first, I'm just teaching the parts of the welder. So not only do I have like the PowerPoint and the audio, but I actually have for the visual learners, the welder itself. So when I talk about the electrode holder, they know that that's where the rod goes when welding. So they can actually see it. When I talk about the cables and the ground and everything else, they can actually see it. And then once we hit that part, we move the welders back out into the shop, and then we actually get their hands dirty, and then they start to weld. So all types of learners, and the main three are, you know, people learn from audio, people learn from seeing, people learn from hands-on. So it's hitting all of those people in one unit. And I try to do that in every single unit that I teach. So if I have a agronomy lesson on weeds, so teaching that, I also have the weed in, and then I also have them so they can actually look and try to identify the weeds. So making sure that all types of kids are learning that. So I try to incorporate it all the time.
Flesh this out just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Your statement of the classroom as a staging area.
Yes.
Where we really need to be. I guess that's kind of what you were just talking
yes.
about.
I think, and of course, it doesn't work with every lesson, and it doesn't work with every administrator. I have pretty good administrators that I tell kids, okay, I sometimes forewarn the kids, okay, tomorrow we're going to a field, so dress appropriately. And so I go, we meet in the classroom, get on the bus, go to the field, and do the lesson actually in the field. Or if I have to go to the veterinarian's office, we go to the vet's office. I try to get them out of the classroom and into the real world, yeah, so that they are understanding of where this is being used. And I think that's the biggest thing right now. The kids need to see, you know, why are you teaching this?
Yeah.
So this way you can say, this is why we teach this.
And as you're empowering these students and they're, yeah, empowering themselves, you say agriculture is a science. And,
yes,
and the old way of, well, that's just the way we do it, son, yes, or daughter. Mm-hmm. Doesn't quite cut it.
No, it doesn't. I mean, even today, mom and dad still tell the kids, this is the way we've always done it, and this is the way we're going to continue to do it. And the kids come to me and ask me, why are they doing it that way? And so we kind of get into, you know, why does my dad pick this bull all the time? Or, you know, why do they plant this crop all the time? So you kind of go, well, that's what the market is after right now. And why do you sell it this time of the year versus other times? So we kind of go, all of that to me is a science, because we actually get into studying it. And sometimes we do like a little agri science experiment, even if it's like studying the market. You know, that's not really science, but they study why people sell crops at certain times of the year.
You said right now you're working on an operation game,
yes,
for the vet science class.
Yeah.
And implementing technology and,
yes,
utilizing it and having that technology be effective seems really key,
yes,
for your classroom.
Currently, I'm looking for the parts. Everyone kind of knows that operation game where, yeah, you go in and you try not to hit the buzzer. Well, they don't make an animal one, so I'm going to make a dog one. And so right now I'm just collecting all of the parts to make the operation game. So I try to just sometimes I think it's more for me. I like to build my, you know, if I wanted to, I probably could build the bovine breeder, you know, but we purchased one. But sometimes it's just fun to build it. And so if I keep continuing to build this stuff, kids are drawn in. Like, for example, fall we did an ethanol. So I taught kids about biofuels, plant energy. And so, you know, we made our own distiller instead of, you know, just using a Gatorade bottle and some equipment from the science lab, easily make a distiller, and the kids produce their own ethanol for the biofuels lab.
And you mentioned the kids are more active and attentive, mm-hmm, and engaged in class. And,
yes.
And you're putting out problems that they have to find solutions for.
Yes. That's one thing about inquiry base is that you kind of give them the challenge, and then they go through the process of solving the solution to get the end results. So, for example, if you go back to the biofuel, you know, I gave them an assortment of different types of corn, like cream of corn, molasses, anything that made from corn. They got to pick, they research which one would probably make the best ethanol. And then they went through and, you know, it's like a 5-day lesson of watching the corn ferment and produce the ethanol and then burning it off. So the kids are finding out which product makes the best ethanol versus me just saying, hey, it's cream of corn. And granted, you know, we don't have access to corn. And we do use corn from the field too, but you just use the resources that you can find.
And it seems like an authentic learning experience when, as you say, students can defend their,
yes,
results. That tells me that they actually know,
yes,
what they're learning.
Yeah, so when the lesson's done or the activity is done, they're allowed, you know, I can question it, but then they're allowed to defend it. Even if they're wrong, I allow them to defend it, because sometimes I'm not grading on, is it correct? I'm grading on, are they defending it, their result? Are they confident in what they are doing? Because that's what we kind of need to be teaching these kids is when you go out, be confident, defend what you want to do. And then when you're done, if they have the incorrect answer or incorrect project, we will visit about that. But sometimes it's not always right or wrong. It's, are they confident in what they're doing?
And as you touched on earlier, oftentimes there's more than
one
way to find the finish line.
Yeah, because each kid learns different. When it comes to an assessment, sometimes I allow the kids to choose how they want to be assessed. If they want a paper test because that's what they like, they can take a paper test. If they wanted to do a oral test, I'll give them. If they wanted to do a hands-on test, I allow all of that, because this way they're showing me that this is how they learn best. Not every kid can take a test, written test, but they can talk perfectly and they know the answer. So why not? Yes, it's more work on me, but in the end, we're supposed to be educating them. So it's kind of what education is going down that road. Like, I know the other day the kids go, we never use PowerPoints in here. And I go, because it's old school. To me, it's old school.
I really like this statement too, where you said inquiry-based learning ties academic classes and career and technical education together.
Yeah. So what they are learning in both academic classes, like your core classes and then your CTE courses, they should be working together so that kids can use them in both areas. Because there's different ways, you know, they're learning percentages in math. Well, how do you use percentages in agriculture? So, for example, you're pre-yielding. You know, what do you expect? Sometimes all that is a percentage. Okay, I think 90% of this field is going to be great. So kids are learning how to use both. They're using scientific method in science class. They're using scientific method in CTE courses too. So it kind of ties them together. To me, it makes them equal.
17 of your years have been in Rolla.
Yes.
So you've invested a lot of time in that community. Kids coming back, have they told you, thanks, Mr. Fritz?
They have. I think that is probably the best reward that you can get as a teacher. You know, you can hang all the Teacher of the Year plaques you want on your wall, but that doesn't mean anything to me. But when a student comes back and says, you know what, you really helped me in this unit. We mastered, like, welding. I mean, I'm big with welding. I make sure the kids are great because it's one of my favorite subjects to teach. The kids just come back and say, you know, in college, we just zipped right through that unit because we got to work ahead. We got to do everything. And they were impressed that I knew so much about how to weld. So, yeah, I think it's great when kids come back. And even when they come back, and I did have a kid come back and say, you know what, they don't do much gas welding anymore. So cut way back on that. So I'm also using them to make sure that what I'm teaching is relevant to their future. And I also do that with business owners too. What are you looking for in an employee, or what does this job entail sometimes? I just want to make sure that I'm not teaching that something that's outdated and no longer used.
Well, the 21st century skills seem to be alive and well in your class. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of collaboration, certainly critical thinking, a lot of communication. I mean, all of these things seem like they're pushed right to the forefront.
It is. I do believe that we have to prepare these kids. I think I heard somewhere that we should be teaching kids for jobs that don't exist right now. And so you're kind of just giving them everything that could possibly be out there, making sure that they're ready to enter that workforce if that's where they're going, or if they're going into college right away, just to have them ready. I mean, so they have an understanding of what they're getting into.
Yeah, to be career ready no matter what.
Exactly.
Is important, because so many, back to those days, you just, who really knows what they want to do? That's a tricky waters to navigate.
Yeah, it is. And like one activity we do every Wednesday, we go to Kiwanis Club. I send kids to Kiwanis Club. And then they come back and say, okay, this is what, because it's business owners and community people, this is what they want. And so that activity, the kids are thinking, getting even just the soft skills of talking, because every week the kids have to be the presenters at the Kiwanis Club. So I go, even if you're talking about something non-agriculture related, they want to know what you're doing. And at the same time, they want to know if you can speak to an adult.
William Fritz, agriculture instructor from Mount Pleasant High School in Rolla, North Dakota. We appreciate so much you joining me here on this episode of the Cutting Edge Podcast.
Yes, you're welcome. So it was fun.
That was National Agri-Science teacher William Fritz from Rolla talking with Cutting Edge Podcast host Tom Gerhart. The Cutting Edge is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, and entrepreneur Ted Dintersmith. You can learn more about the Cutting Edge Podcast at ndunited.org. Next on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
The setting is a beauty salon in small town Louisiana, where all the ladies come to have their hair done and entertain each other with hilarious repartee. But tragedy strikes when the prettiest girl in town, Shelby, loses her life during a risky pregnancy. Now the ladies have to come together with strength and love, and they give this story a special quality, making it truly touching and marvelously funny. Dakota Stage in Bismarck proudly presents Steel Magnolias, March 14th through the 16th and the 21st through the 24th. More information and tickets are available at the door or online at dakotastageltd.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and the author and voice of the Plains Folk essays we share every week on our show. Today, Tom talks about a personality from our state's past who presents a familiar dilemma, a person who had some good ideas and some less good.
The name Bertha Rachel Palmer has an ambiguous resonance in our history on the Northern Plains. I have written in admiration of her 1928 book, Beauty Spots in North Dakota. Indeed, have offered metaphorically to carry her bags for a tour of the Flickertail State. On the other hand, Bertha Rachel Palmer represents some ideas and habits that make many of us today uncomfortable. For instance, she stands for old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon dominance, to the tacit neglect, if not outright exclusion, of other ethnic stocks, meaning the ancestors of most all of us in North Dakota. Palmer's family roots are spread through the 19th century religious revival movement known as the Second Great Awakening, giving her a zealous outlook on the world, but they also go deeper into colonial origins. She was an enthusiastic member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, which is fine. It's good to take pride in your antecedents. But the importance to her of multiple organizations emphasizing an ancestral elite indicates an inability to recognize and appreciate the richness of the ethnic landscape. Reexamining Beauty Spots of North Dakota, I see that you could read it cover to cover and remain innocent of the immigrant heritage of the place. No foreigners to be found. Well, maybe a few Norwegians, if they had artistic attainments. Then there are the causes to which Palmer devoted her life following her public service in North Dakota. A graduate of Mayville Normal School, she was an outstanding educator, to be sure, and a feminist of the classic type for her generation. She served as deputy to State Superintendent of Public Instruction Minnie Nielsen in the 1920s and won election to that post for herself in 1926. She spent her life after 1933 in service to the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She wrote bulletins and did educational work for the WCTU. Let us not, in this era of legalization and liberalization, fall into the trap of stereotyping temperance and prohibition people of the past as benighted curmudgeons. Prohibition was not a farce. It worked pretty well in many parts of the country. And prohibitionists were right when they pointed to the disastrous effects of alcohol on individuals and families. Still, I'm looking now at one of Palmer's bulletins, A Syllabus in Alcohol Education, 1933. Sure, the language is updated. It speaks of the danger of alcoholic intoxication instead of the horrors of drunkenness, and dispenses lessons in alcohol education instead of temperance lectures. Two, Palmer makes some good scientific points about the deleterious physiological effects at the cell level of alcohol use. On the other hand, she still harkens back to, she says, the shame of Noah, Lot, Ahasuerus, the disasters of Nabal, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, because of strong drink. She argues that alcohol somehow makes the bed for tuberculosis and is responsible for from 76% to 80% of venereal infection. So, the Bertha Rachel Palmer, with whom I am willing to travel, is the one who wrote Beauty Spots in North Dakota, not the one who wrote the syllabus in alcohol education. As we drive around North Dakota, I would like to introduce her to the glories of German-Russian cuisine and to the virtues of some of our landscapes, such as the Missouri Coteau, that are perhaps not sublime, but are nevertheless a balm to the soul. I hope she packs light and brings sensible walking shoes.
That was Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura will have a natural North Dakota essay. Sue Balcom will join us for another segment of Main Street Eats. And we'll share our What's Happening calendar of things to do after the storm. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota Republican lawmakers say changes are needed in that state's Department of Human Services to crack down on child care fraud. Following a report from the legislative auditor, they're demanding a management shakeup. The auditor's report says there is an undetermined amount of fraud going on in the child care assistance program. There's a claim the fraud tops $100 million, but investigators could not substantiate that amount. Republican Representative Mary Franzen of Alexandria questioned the need for additional state spending on child care until the problem is fixed.
If the Department of Human Services actually took fraud seriously, we wouldn't be talking about adding additional dollars into that program to alleviate that wait list.
DHS Commissioner Tony Lori says he takes the auditor's report seriously and his agency has been working on improvements. The House has passed a bill that would impose road use fees for plug-in hybrid vehicles in North Dakota. North Dakota currently collects a gas tax from motorists to fund its roads and infrastructure, but drivers of plug-in hybrids or electric cars skirt that tax by not using as much, if any, gasoline. The annual road use fees would be $120 for electric cars, $50 for plug-in hybrids, and $20 for electric motorcycles. Democratic Representative Ron Gugisberg said he would vote in favor of the bill, but he hopes further discussion on how to pay for roads and infrastructure would be had in the near future.
We have a DOT budget of $1.275 billion. If the numbers are right about the electric cars, this bill will raise about $150,000. This is not going to fix our problem. We need to increase the gas tax or be serious about finding out another solution for funding this and not just talking about it.
The bill passed 72-17 and now goes to Governor Burgum for his signature. And the Fargo-Moorhead United Patriotic Bodies will march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade after all. The veterans withdrew from the parade after they were told they would have to pay a $50 fee to participate. Melissa Rademacher of the Downtown Community Partnership says service organizations are refunded the fee, but the veterans weren't told about that policy.
There is a $50 charge. And so basically those services, similar to what we do with Holiday Lights Parade, is that you still need to register just so we know that you are showing up. And then we actually refund those service groups like we do with Holiday Lights Parade and things like that.
United Patriotic Bodies Commander Jason Hicks says he's very glad the issue has been resolved. The parade is scheduled for Saturday at 11 a.m. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, Fargo Democratic Senator Kathy Hogan discusses behavioral health issues, a redesign of human services, and some of the other big-ticket spending items. That's Legislative Review at 6:30 p.m. Central Time Friday here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota essays have been a mainstay of Prairie Public for several years. Chuck used to teach biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he still shares his love of the natural world with his Natural North Dakota essays. Today, his topic is the history and causes of prairie fire.
Picture this. It's early October 1803. You're in what we now know as Northeast North Dakota, near where the Park River flows into the Red River. You are keeping a journal, and part of the day's entry is that fire is raging at every point of the compass. Thick clouds of smoke nearly deprive us of the sight of the sun, and at night the view from the top of my house is awful indeed. Those are the observations of Alexander Henry. I recently read Interpretation and Compendium of Historical Fire Accounts in the Northern Great Plains by Ken Higgins. Higgins read historical journals, diaries, and other accounts from early explorers, traders, and trappers to document fires in the Great Plains prior to 1900. He documented and summarized around 300 references to fire. We've all heard about the early fires on the prairies. Surprisingly, however, based on these observations, the frequency of lightning-caused fires is much less than those set by Native Americans. Meriwether Lewis's journal entry for March 6, near present-day Stanton, alludes to this. Quote, "The day was cloudy and smoky in consequence of the burning of the plains by the Minotauris. They have set all the neighboring country on fire in order to obtain an early crop of grass, which may answer for the consumption of their horses, and also as an inducement for the buffalo and other game to visit it," unquote. These fires are mostly scattered, single events of short duration and small extent. Native American set fires were documented for every month except January. The fires were conducted in two periods, one occurring from March through May, with the peak period occurring in April, and the other occurring from July to early November, with the peak in October. Native Americans burned the prairie a lot, and for several reasons, such as to improve forage and attract game, aid in hunting, eliminate the signs of their presence or activity, for signaling, such as a warning or a threat, and to ease travel. Although much has been written about the devastating effects of fire, Higgins notes that the effects of the bison have received scant attention. He speculates that the effects of the bison may have been even more significant than that of the fires. But we'll save that topic for another day. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we continue our conversation about correspondence we've received on the Constitution.
We started to talk about the importance of the United States Constitution because of what I think is going to be a whopping constitutional crisis in the year 2019. And lots of people have weighed in with their own thoughts about what the Constitution might need by way of amendment.
And we also received some interesting email, including a listener in Texas who sort of took you to task for offering to give up a North Dakota senator.
There's nothing I love more than the state of North Dakota, and yet I believe that we probably only deserve one senator, and that has led to some backlash by people from elsewhere who've probably never been to North Dakota, but I love that they want to champion the two Senate equality rule for this Constitution.
We also talk a bit about the 14th Amendment. So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in the studio in Fargo, and in our studio in Bismarck, Sue Balcom joins us.
Sue, thanks as always for joining us for another episode of Main Street Eats.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Excited because it's almost St. Patrick's Day?
I am. But I draw the line at green beer, okay?
Me
I'm
too.
Sorry. It's just not on my list of basic four food groups. So,
well, as a good German Russian, what are you doing on St. Patrick's Day?
Well, you know, I remember making green cake donuts and doing a few things because at one time I was married to someone of Irish descent, and maybe I'm married to someone who has a little Irish in him now.
Doesn't everybody?
I don't think I do. And I've
St. Patrick's Day, everyone.
Okay, all right. If you want to go that far. I had a friend, though, that was kind of half German and half Irish, and God bless him, he said, you know, the Irish in me just loved to drink, but the German in me would never let me enjoy it.
That didn't stop the German, though.
Oh, shoot. No, we can wine in our beer at the best of them. So, but I did a little research on St. Patrick's Day because I was curious again about what they do over in Ireland on St. Patrick's Day, which boo-boo number one is they call it St. Paddy's Day. They never call it St. Patrick's Day. So if you want to be true Irish, you got to walk around and talk about St. Paddy. And they don't eat corned beef, Doug.
Well, that's because they live in the wrong country, Sue.
They do eat a rasher of bacon, though, for a traditional fried Irish breakfast. If you've never had one, I don't know how those people stay skinny because, boy, they eat bacon and they fry their tomatoes. They make brown soda bread and tea, and they eat that with eggs any way they want, fried, of course. And then they do have something called black pudding, which is actually a blood sausage, which is somewhat of a tradition in our family also. But, ooh, the thought of that just doesn't sound good when you can have all these other wonderful things.
Well, that's a staple of the full English breakfast, too. So all of this stuff is, in a sense. I mean, that's a full plate. The English, the Irish, the Scots, they eat hearty in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the rule to staying thin, you know. You eat like a king in the morning, a prince at noon, and a pauper at night. So they had the right idea there. So,
and you can walk in the winter.
Oh, yeah. 2 miles uphill to school through 6 feet of snow every day, right? I was there once. But they have such wonderful, other wonderful things like brown soda bread that they make with whole wheat flour. And I just found this out, too. I've started making some soda bread in preparation for St. Patty's Day. And the cross in the top of that bread is etched in the center. Do you know why?
I suspect it might have to do something with St. Patrick, but I don't know.
It's to keep the fairies out.
Oh.
Oh, sure.
And I'm like, out of what? Out of your house? Out of your food? Off your plate? I don't know. I don't. But I thought that was kind of cute. You know, we all have these little things that we do sometimes and we don't even know we're doing them. So,
what is soda bread?
Oh, soda bread is so awesome. You know how sourdough bread is risen with bacteria and cultures that you capture from the air called mm-hmm. wild yeast. Yeast breads, of course, you use the purchased yeast that you buy in the store, which is actually somewhat of a fungus or mold sort of thing that makes your bread rise. But the Irish make this wonderful brown bread with soda in it, lots of soda and baking powder and flour and water, basically, and you can flavor it any way you want. But it's like it doesn't rise as much. It's more like eating a wonderful soft biscuit. And they do a lot. It's so easy to make that they do a lot of Irish bread. Everybody that goes over to Ireland and comes back says to me, can't you make Irish soda bread? That bread is so wonderful. Well, we can and we can't because they do have a special wheat that they use over there that supposedly gives it a certain flavor. But we still, that hasn't stopped any of us from eating my soda bread. So.
Well, another bakery staple of the United Kingdom and Ireland is scones.
Oh, my gosh. And I don't know if people around here just haven't ever had a really good scone or not. But, you know, the ones that you can get in the local coffee shops are like failed muffins in my mind. Because a real scone is crispy, flaky on the outside and tender and delightful in the inside. And I love scones. I love scones so much that when I just don't know what to have for a snack, I'll whoop some up because it only takes about 20 minutes. But then you have to bake them. But scones are kind of, they're a flour with butter cut into them. So they're sort of started out life like a pie crust. But then you add a little sugar and you add milk and eggs to them. And then, of course, you can flavor them any way you want. Plain ones are just about like a biscuit. They eat them with butter or clotted cream. But you can add raisins and craisins and brown sugar and cinnamon and orange peel and lemon peel. And they're just fabulous, fabulous. Right out of the oven is when they're the most fabulous.
I think of them like bagels in a way. People are very fussy about scones and bagels. You know, they have to be a certain way.
Right. It's got to be the real deal or nothing at all. So I did find some recipes that I would be happy to post on my blog site. And one of them is called Gemma's Best Ever Irish Scones. And I just can't wait to try her recipe because it looks phenomenal. And I think if you were to put like cheese in them, like grated cheddar cheese, you could actually eat them with chicken and gravy, too, if you wanted to do that.
Oh, twist my arm.
Yeah, come on over. And then, of course, we have to have an Irish dessert, right? They eat a lot of apple tart over there, which is very similar to our apple pie over here. The difference is they kind of bake it in a little more shallow pan. And, of course, they all use Kerrygold pure Irish salted butter.
That's the best.
Because, right, if you've never tasted really good butter, that's, I would recommend treating yourself on St. Patty's Day this year with some Kerrygold butter smothered over the top of a wonderful scone or maybe a piece of soda bread when you're having breakfast, and then top it off with that apple tart, you know?
Well, how about this? So what about the day after St. Patty's Day?
Yeah, we need a hangover cure here.
I couldn't believe that when I read that. I thought that was pretty amazing. I haven't had a hangover in a really long time, but I don't remember them as being very much fun, unless you're with a bunch of friends. Maybe then it's not so bad. But the Irish have cures for hangovers, two of them. One of them is drinking flat 7-Up, which, as you know, is sort of like what you drink when you have the flu.
Yeah.
But they also butter white bread, fry up some good Irish potato crisps, and make themselves a what's called a crisp sandwich, which is basically those potatoes stuffed inside buttered bread. And I'm not going to try it.
It seems like it would sop up a lot of stuff in the stomach. Like, it, yeah, I get it.
Okay. And drink plenty of flat 7-Up there. And then it probably expands, fills your stomach. And, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit of grease and a little bit of whatever.
That might be a recipe for moderation. All right. Well, we've checked in with Sue Belkin, as we do every week. Sue, what's your blog address?
TheRootSellers, SELLERS.com.
Thank you, Sue.
What's happening is next.
Next time on The Pulse.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
When disaster strikes, what are our best chances of survival?
Drop, cover, and hold on.
How do we prepare for the worst as communities?
Writing out plans, thinking through scenarios.
And individuals.
Having a water bottle in your purse at all times.
Dealing with disasters on The Pulse.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Well, there's probably a little weather going on just everywhere that you're listening to this show today, and I hope you're not listening in your car or your pickup. You're by that nice warm radio at home. I'm here with Christine McClellan. We're going to look at our What's Happening list of things to do for, you know, the week that happens after.
And when it gets nicer,
yeah.
Hopefully. All right, so we got a pop-up perishable food program. This is going to be in Mayville at the Mayport High School parking lot on Friday, March 15th. Trucks supplying fresh vegetables, bakery items, and boxed goods will be in the community as part of the Great Plains Food Bank pop-up perishable food program. Anyone in need of food assistance is welcome to attend and receive food at no cost. Individuals attending the distribution event are asked to bring Go Green bags or boxes to take food home with them. So this starts at 10 a.m. and goes until noon, and it's free to attend.
All right. Who Made Who is the title of a play, a farce, at Friday at West Fargo at Bonanzaville. The Harwood Prairie Playhouse presents its 35th season of comedy with a production of Who Made Who by Fargo playwright David Lassig. He's been writing farces that the Harwood players have been doing for quite a while now, and they're a lot of fun to watch, you know. Lots of yucks. And it's an interesting place as well. So it'll be 2 hours of nonstop laughter, they're promising. That's at Bonanzaville, Friday evening, the hours from 7:30 to 9:30. The cost for a ticket to Who Made Who is $15.
There's a home-delivered meals benefit in Mandan at the Golden Age Senior Center on Sunday, March 17th. Come out for a great benefit for an even better cause, sponsored by Mandan's Starian Bank. Fill up on some delicious French toast, ham, and French fruit with coffee and orange juice. Donations will go toward delivering healthy food to community members who are in need of assistance preparing or buying their own meals. So this starts at 8:30 a.m. and goes until 12:30 p.m. And it's free, but they're accepting free will donations.
Well, here's another Sunday event, Trilax, an introductory lacrosse experience for kids. It's in Grand Forks at the UND Athletic Center on Sunday. Boys and girls ages 6 to 12 are invited to come out and give the fun sport of lacrosse a try. Every child will receive a complimentary warrior,
boy or brine girl stick, ball, and T-shirt. You can register at uslacrosse.org/trilax. That's T-R-Y-L-A-X. The hours are from 1:30 to 2:30 on Sunday afternoon, again at the UND Athletic Center in Grand Forks. The cost is $20. Sounds like fun.
This is kind of fun, too. This is a square dance and potluck hosted by the Country Twirlers in Minnesota. So this is going to be at the IOOF Hall in Detroit Lakes on March 15th.
International Order of Odd Fellows.
Hey, I didn't know that. And it starts at 7 p.m. and goes until 10 p.m.
Sounds like fun there, too. Country Twirlers. So, well, Prairie Paws Meet and Greet is Saturday from 11 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. This is at the Jamestown Tractor Supply Company in Jamestown. You can meet the pets available for adoption from Prairie Paws Rescue. These are pets that have been abandoned or from puppy mills, owner surrenders, strays, and from area pounds. So lots to choose from, I suspect. All of the medical work is completed prior to adoption for an adoption fee with an approved application. So they want to do the right thing by these pets. That should make you feel good. For a current list of pets, you can go to the website at prairiepawsrescue.com. Again, it's from 11 to 1 on Saturday at the Jamestown Tractor Supply Company.
The International Artist Series of Minot is presenting Ilya Yakushev. This is going to be Sunday, March 17th. Starts at 2 p.m., goes until 5 at the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. Ilya Yakushev is an award-winning Russian pianist, and his program will feature compositions by Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, and Gershwin, as well as a multimedia presentation, which makes his performance visual and technical spectacular. So tickets are $15 for students or $30 for adults.
The Viking Fire Department in Viking, Minnesota is holding their annual spaghetti supper. It's 4:30 till 8 o'clock on Saturday evening. Come out and support the Viking Fire Department at their annual spaghetti supper. Enjoy a tasty meal, a silent auction, and raffles. The location is at the Viking School in Viking, Minnesota. The admission is a free will donation, but this is a fundraiser, so think about that. And there is, of course, a silent auction and a spaghetti supper. So 4:30 to 8 in Viking, Minnesota, the Viking Fire Department's annual spaghetti supper. What's your pick this week?
My pick this week is with our own Scott Prebis, An Afternoon of Great Jazz. This is going to be at the Heritage Center in Bismarck on Sunday, March 17th. This is sponsored by us and the Heritage Center, and it features Prairie Public host Scott Prebis with 8 musicians presenting a varied program of traditional and contemporary jazz. So that starts at 2 p.m. Again, it's at the Heritage Center on March 17th, and it's free to attend.
And Scott is a percussionist, so he'll be hitting the drums, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, mine is just a reminder that we had this person on earlier this week, a really interesting author, Victoria Johnson, who'd written about a famous doctor and botanist in New York City around the turn of the 19th century. That's like 1800. It's the 14th Annual National Book Awards at Concordia College, and we mentioned that there'd be a special author event on Thursday evening. Well, it's Thursday, and I think people are staying inside. They've canceled the Thursday evening event. The book awards, though, on campus for those students and faculty, and it's always a fun event for them. So that's what's happening.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, Fargo Film Festival director Emily Beck previews the upcoming 19th Annual Fargo Film Festival with all the sights and sounds, and we'll have film clips from the winning films next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 14th. On this date in 1913, hundreds of thousands of tons of North Dakota coal was being eaten up by fires in undeveloped mines. Coal is not usually the first thing that comes to mind when people think of North Dakota, but in 1913, a geologist estimated that the state had 32,000 square miles of coal fields containing 500 billion tons of coal. The coal fires had the state legislature alarmed at what they called the wanton destruction of a valuable state resource. The coal fires were not new. The earliest written reference comes from Lewis and Clark when they were wintering at Mandan in 1805. Lewis had observed such fires and believed they caused the discoloration of rock that could be seen in the river bluffs. Some explorers, including Fremont, Nicolet, and Audubon,
thought the discolored rock was volcanic, but Lewis's interpretation proved correct. Several other explorers reported coal fires on the Great Plains. Some were ignited by prairie fires. The coal fires could burn for a long time. A seam of lignite at Buck Hill burned from 1951 to 1977. In 1976, prairie fires ignited lignite seams over a 7,000-acre area near Amadon. Although those were extinguished fairly quickly by coal fire standards, they still burned for several months. One fire near Bowman burned for decades and became something of a tourist attraction. It finally burned out in the late 1970s. In 1988, widespread prairie fires in the Badlands started coal fires when juniper tree roots burned down to the coal. In 2008, a coal fire was reported near I-94, about 13 miles west of Bismarck. It was only 100 yards from the interstate. With coal fires notoriously difficult to extinguish, state officials had to consider whether to make an effort to put the fire out or let it burn out on its own. Concluding that the fire was about 4 feet underground and in no danger of undermining the highway, they made the decision to let it burn. One safety concern, officials warned that the fires are very hot, and someone who ventures close can slip into the fire if the ground gives way. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
They came from across North Dakota, each the champion of their school. They worked, they trained. They came to Bismarck to compete, to win at reading poetry.
How do we separate the things from a man, the man from the things? Is a man still the same without his reins?
Who live off the chorus, the trio singing, loosened organs with melodious screwdrivers.
I'm hardly virginal, if you know what I mean. No one knew exactly what she meant.
This Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, hear all about the state finals of the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition. The top winners and more doing poetry and talking about it. These students know what to do with a poem. Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, P-O-E-T-R-Y Poetry.
Elizabeth Warren has big ideas for her 2020 campaign, such as taxing billionaires like Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos.
When you make it really, really, really big, put a little back in the kitty so that the next kid gets a chance, and the kid after that, and the kid after that.
The latest of our opening arguments from presidential candidates on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, Nate Heinold and Travis Rosenbluth are the co-founders of Harvestable, a service that helps local growers market to restaurants. On our show on Friday, they'll talk about their startup and its reception at the South by Southwest Festival, where it was selected for special recognition. We'll have our weekly news chat with News Director Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean will review the newest blockbuster, Captain Marvel. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, stay warm and enjoy the rest of your day.